each of the panelists to speak for about 5 minutes each. Then we will have a discussion of about 20 minutes and hopefully leave 20 minutes open for just questions and general discussion. So I'd like to have this be a real discussion section. To give you a little bit of context on the topic of the evolutionary origins of the self, here's a slide. You've probably all seen trees of life, and very often trees of life sort of have humans at the top. Again, 18th century, 19th century thinking. This is a tree of life published a couple of years ago. It's scaled roughly to diversity. So distance in this tree roughly represents biological diversity. And you can see that almost everything up here are single-celled organisms. And in fact, everything except on the extreme right are bacteria and archaea, so not even cells like us. And the red arrow there points to animals. Actually, on the tree, it's labeled metazoa, which are organisms that have layers, like we have layers, inside and outside. And up there in the kind of blob above there, there's a little branch labeled plants. And you'll notice that critters like mushrooms are actually much more closely related to us than they are to plants. But the big story here is that life is extremely diverse. We and all the organisms that are familiar to us as macroscopic organisms are stuck in a little tiny corner of the diversity spectrum. And almost all of the biological diversity is in the single-celled world. And most of the diversity is in the non-eukaryotic, so the microbial, the true microbial world. Some old colleagues of mine, Bob Robbins and John Woolley, published a paper recently in which they pointed out something that's obvious once you hear it, but which, as far as I know, had never been pointed out before, that macroscopic organisms like us interact with the world mechanically. So I can pick up my glasses and move them around. I'm doing a mechanical operation here. But that in almost all of life, all but the handful of macroscopic organisms, the interaction with the world is not mechanical at all. It's chemical. And so the kind of sensations and the kinds of actions that you see in almost all of life bears essentially no resemblance whatsoever to the kinds of sensations and actions that we execute in our macroscopic bodies, which, as Neil pointed out a couple of days ago in his talk, are just enormous colonies of single cells. So with that as sort of an introduction and context setting by what do we mean by life and what do we mean potentially by the evolution of the self, I'd just like to introduce the questions that I sent to the panel a few days ago to guide this discussion. The first of them is, when did the self first appear? Are cells ubiquitous throughout life? Or is the self a relatively new kind of experience? What kind of self was it when it first appeared? So is the self of the creature called Luca in that last slide, which means last universal common ancestor. If Luca had a self, what was Luca's self like? And if you look carefully at that picture, you'll notice that in current thinking, Luca, our last common ancestor, was actually before DNA, even. So very, very old. And then the third question is the one that I think is the most important and that I hope that members of the panel will talk about and then we can discuss, which is, if we think of life in terms of consciousness and selves and so on, with these concepts that we've grown up attributing to ourselves, how does that change the way we interact with life? How does it change the way we try to understand life? What new questions does it allow us to ask in the laboratory? What new experiments might it allow us to do? What new insights does it bring to us as biologists or just as people in general? So, enough of that from me. I'm going to ask Neil to start this discussion, and then Catherine, and then Stuart, and then we'll have kind of a general talk. And I'll ask questions to the extent that you all don't. So, Neil.
Okay. This is okay, sound-wise? Okay. What pays my bills is I'm an MD and a diagnostic pathologist specializing in the liver. So that means I spend a lot of my day looking at a microscope at a different level of scale from what all of us do the rest of the time, looking at liver biopsies from people, figuring out if they have cancer, not cancer, viral hepatitis, transplant rejection, things like that. And I think that to some extent that sort of daily experience of moving between scales has conditioned how I think about these things. That clinical work led me to explore liver stem cells. It was my group that showed that the liver has stem cells, and then from there we went into adult stem cell plasticity, and my group's paper sort of sparked Bush's address to the nation on stem cells, so unintended consequences, whoops. Lots of anti-abortion crowd. People wanted me to come talk to their groups after that because I obviously was opposed to embryonic stem cell research. And I said, do you really want this New York Jewish homosexual Buddhist coming to your group? And then they stopped calling me, so it was fine. That led me to an art collaboration with a woman named Jane Prophet, who introduced me to complexity theory and the work of Stu Kaufman, amongst others. And so people now call me a complexity theorist, although it's ridiculous. You know, I walk into this room and he's sitting there. No, I'm a complexity dabbler. And what that perspective basically led me to was that, just as Chris just said, so the body at this level of scale interacts mechanically. We are sort of like a machine. We're objects that are separate from each other. At the microscopic level, we're not things at all. The way you look at a flock of birds in the sky, it looks solid, it looks like an object, but you know it's birds. In the same way, you come look at a body at the microscopic level, the bird disappears, my finger disappears, it's just a community of cells, most of which aren't even human. 90 to 99% of them are not human, and without them, you wouldn't be alive as what you think of as yourself. And then when you go down, but you go further, and you go down to the nanoscopic level, is that me?
No.
That was me, sorry.
Oh, it's rubbing against your beard. Non-local, it's rubbing against his beard. Okay, so, Swami Biyandananda got me started, I guess. So, quick. But you don't stop there. Are cells inherent things that exist independent, no matter how you look at them? No, because if you go down to the nanoscopic level, they are merely assemblies of biomolecules afloat in water. And so what about the molecules? Are they things? No, they're just atoms that are self-organized. And those are just subatomic particles that have self-organized. And those are just smaller subatomic particles self-organizing. And those are just either strings or something we don't know precisely what that are coming in and out of the vacuum, energy turning into matter and sinking back in again. So there is no thing in this hierarchy, or a better word, holarchy of the universe, that isn't part of a self-organizing system, and none of it has any inherent existence. There's no thing you can point to that is always a thing independent of perspective. Implication of that is I hold my finger up, and at this level of scale, I'm bounded by my skin. And if I think of myself at this level of scale, this is where I stop. But at the cellular level, I've left bacteria all over the place here, and all of us, if you live with anybody or with pets, you are a shared microbiome, and your microbiome has one, two, or three, depending on how many household members you have, islands on which they live. and they're really the main thing going on in your apartment or your home. It's not you. And when you shake hands with someone, then your boundary has extended. At the atomic level, there's no atom in your body that has not been drunk, eaten, or breathed from the planet. So you can think of what we typically think of ourselves as beings that live on the Earth. But it's just equivalently true that you are the Earth that has self-organized into beings that think of themselves as separate. But at the atomic level, your boundary is at least the entire planet. And when you go to the quantum realm, then you're talking about non-locality and you've got to the whole universe. Where this has led me, research philosophy-wise, I work with Menas Kefatos, who many of you have heard speak here this weekend. And what we're positing, at least as an equivalent idea compared to the idea that brain makes mind, is that fundamental awareness is what underlies everything. And that becoming aware of itself, the non-dual, slipping into duality gives rise to space, time, matter, and energy in the whole universe. And we call that a fundamental awareness, and it's a framework to cross talk between philosophy, science, metaphysics, etc. Okay. So then how all that relates to these questions to me, there are a couple of different ways to answer it in 1 minute. One is this boundedness being scale and perspective dependent means the self is scale and perspective dependent. So to talk about a self is true only from certain perspectives. And at other perspectives, like a state of samadhi, where you're in continuity with the whole universe, it doesn't make any sense to say that. Or the self then becomes the unbounded, extending out to the universe. And neither one of those things is true to the exclusion of the other. And Manas and I talk about this as complementarity, like wave-particle duality is complementarity. No one understanding gives you the complete picture. The moment you conceptually latch on to one definition, you lose something. If you switch to capture that other something, you lose that. So the idea of the self in the first place, there is no such thing as a reified self, but that doesn't mean selves don't exist. They exist in certain perspectives and in certain circumstances, depending on where you put your attention. Simple thought experiment, and then I think I'll finish with that. So you think of yourself as a being born of your mother, but if you go and separate, one hopes. But if you go back in time to that moment of conception, there is no moment of discontinuity between the life of your body and the life of your mother's oocyte. Back into her body, all the way back to her mother, and through her mother. Back through all these layers of evolutionary development. We are one continuous living being on the planet going back to those earliest things, and there's no discontinuity anywhere in there. So when you think of yourself as this self, that is true. And we need to think of ourselves as this self because how else are we going to feed ourselves or run from the tiger? There's an evolutionary advantage at some point to thinking of yourself as distinct. But just as equally true is that we are all a part of one living organism that is deluded to think we're separate from each other. And so that's a good solid example, I think, of how this notion of self is perspective dependent, and we're always making a selection, and there is no right selection. There's only an appropriate selection for any particular given moment that's adaptive or not adaptive.
Thank you.
Okay.
Catherine, you want to pick up?
Yes.
Here are your slides.
I'm Catherine Peel Kaufman, married to that guy. And I call myself an interdisciplinary emotion theorist. I've done research into emotion for a long time, both independently and finished up the science and religion program at Harvard Divinity School. So there are several ways to think about what is a self, when did it first appear, both of which come from my work, and I'll be talking tomorrow about emotion. And the main message of my emotion work is this sort of missing piece understanding that emotion is a sensory system, and it serves the function of self-regulation, and that term spans lots of different dimensions. And in fact, Neil was talking yesterday about Niels Bohr asking about complementaries in physics, and there might be wondering about complementaries in biology. And I'm suggesting that the emotional sense is actually ground zero for several logical complementaries that we've sort of missed from our model. So the key idea is that the function is self-regulation and that it is an ancient sense, the first to have emerged, and that the first perceptual qualia were something like what we experience as pleasure and pain. And this was coupled to approach and avoid behaviors so that there was not only the ability to move the body in toward that which is good for me and away from that which is bad for me, but it also provided this coupling of feelings and behaviors, provided the foundation for Pavlovian learning. So it actually ushered the first form of mind. So already we have like a mind self and a body self, and what I like about this, I call this work emotional vitalism, because the emotional sense through this biological lens is actually providing both the animating and the guiding functions that the vitalists thought belonged to force or spirit or soul. So that gives us another way of thinking about self at this deeper level of what that might be as well. So in answer to the first question about when did it emerge, I say that, whoops, I went too far. What did I do? Thank you, my savior. I say that it actually emerged with the origins of life, but that, one more, two more. Here I have the tree of life. This is perfect right here. This is the, if you ask about what the sensory system, what the sensory organ is, excuse me, this is way before brains or anything else. This is the signaling receptome, which in this model, it's a chemical system that works at the sensory receptor within the cell membrane. So this is something that, this is very ancient. And if you look on this family tree, at the very bottom is the 7TM receptor, which is the one that we're talking about, that I mapped the sensory motor circuitry of the E. coli bacterium. And this is the common LUCA receptor that we all share. It responds to peptides, which ancient peptides, which Candace recognizes as the molecules of emotion. There's a whole emotional flow of neuropeptides downward and neurohormones that are part of our regulatory processes, including immune system and everything else. But what I was really cool about this is that this 7TM receptor that every living system has is all about molecular clocks. So it's about the biorhythms, genetic products are made in the right amounts and go to the right places at the right time. So this idea of clocks speaks of maybe some deeper aspect of self that might involve a perception of time. And I can't go into all of it, but let's just look quickly at the arrow of evolution, and that you see, not only do you see a mind-body kind of complementarity where it's moving the body and forging the mind, you also see a dual sense of identity where the self is sort of in the mind that's being developed has both an autonomous identity as an individual and a social identity as a communitarian kind of, and this is all within the individual, and that they're loosely mediated by positive and negative emotions. So even from the very beginning in the E. coli bacterium, through quorum sensing, using just slightly fancier peptides, you not only get me self-regulation, but you also get we self-regulation. So one of the things we've missed in this complementarity is that the individual self that we have has both the mind, not the body, has both a me and a we identity. You see it all the way up the evolutionary scale. You also see emotional behavior in the structures of the brain. So the deeper question here, so if this dual identity of mind might smack of something deeper, more a conceptual, more abstract kind of part to whole relationship, something like what Neil and Minas talk about, something very, very deep within are the self-organizing dynamics, the world, something fractal, where you can get parts and wholes with self-similarity at different levels. And so one of my dualisms that I introduced from this work is this idea that the Cartesian body and mind is actually all over right here in the classical realm, if you will, in the mind body, but that there is something in the self-regulatory sense that's it's dependent on a constant comparison between the self and its not self environment, and it shows up in the immune system and even epigenetic regulation higher up, but that this self not self comparison, even though it yields this beautiful chemical machine, it requires something deeper that I call fundamental, perhaps quantum consciousness, the capacity to observe. So I talk about the mind-body being here, but it's also undergirded by this bottom-up quantum consciousness without, and you need both for this whole process of life and any kind of sentience at all. So that's one of the dualities here. But that I like to suggest that there is not only this top-up self-organization that has this part to hold dynamic and this binaries, but that the complements from above, there's a dynamic actual interaction between the bottom-up self-organizing processes and the top-down self-regulated doing. So it's all part of this deeper self-organizing creative dynamic of the universe. And the implication is that not only do our mindful thoughts and emotions affect our body through the chemistry, but that they might actually go all the way down and tweak probabilities up and down. And that I love Venus and Neil's beautiful picture of the idea that sentience goes all the way down to what might be a unified awareness, which in my model would be the self with a capital S. So you have a small self, ego self, in the mind body, and then you have this bigger, beautiful thing that's constantly interacting with it. So then the self, not self comparison that shows up all the way through here is actually maybe a self, not yet self comparison with something very deep in terms of quantum potentials or the universe becoming to know itself. But what I find really empowering about this new view is that it is a participatory process, and that the ultimately, what we experience as pleasure and pain dispels the notion of a good and evil dichotomy, because it's just not there when you see all the complementary logics that are there. So there's lots of hope, I think. So I think I've answered most of the three questions. It emerged with living systems, and if not multicellularity, the self has these beautiful dualities, but ultimately some unity. And I think that this idea of level independent self-organizing dynamics with parts and wholes, and how there's always this perspective where the inside out, self-relevant, self looking out at its external environment, you have like a series of Russian dolls where at each level there's an external environment and an internal environment. The external environment might be another self looking out on it, but there's this beautiful sort of bottom-up and top-down organization that gives rise to our feelings, frankly. So I think the self is like the coolest thing ever.
I'll just remind you here briefly about these and then turn it over to Stuart. I'll give you your first slide.
Thanks. 30 years ago in polite scientific society, you could not talk about consciousness. It was called by Philip Anderson, the Nobel laureate, the C word. Now we're talking about conscious nerds. It's a C word. Self is even harder than consciousness, and consciousness is very hard. So I want to suggest the following, and we're all having these experiential things in this conference. Awareness has what might be called a dual, that which is aware. There can't be awareness without that which is aware. I can find it in myself, and I'm not a meditator. Try it for a moment in yourself and see if you can find behind the specific awarenesses, like the visual field, there is in myself this sense of that which is aware. I don't know if you can find it, but I can. So let's try the idea that this dual, that which is aware, is the nub, the root of self. By the way, the great philosopher Hume tried to find the self rather like you do, Chris, in your great talk. And he says, all you have is a bundle of awarenesses. So let's try the idea that there's a dual of awareness, that which is aware. The evidence for this, I think, is introspection. And part of what I want to struggle with is, where do you have, what kind of evidence for something like a self? So I'm being both a scientist and a philosopher and whatever. If you say that that awareness has a dual, that which is aware, then you're driven to say, point three, that wherever there is conscious awareness, there has to be its dual, a self. So I'm now going to propose, as I did in my talk a little while ago, that conscious awareness is associated with quantum